Okay, and here we are back, hour number two. Joining us from Europe, Frank Jacob, back for another visit. Packing for Mars, the official movie site, right under his name. And then there's some more material below that, so by all means, get ready to take a look at both of those. Good morning, Frank. How is it over there in Europe?
Good morning, Jeff. Well, it's
dark.
There's been a vicious thunderstorm raging outside, so it's been very interesting.
Yeah, it's a sign, but you'll get through it. All right,
so
talk about packing for Mars here. Let's bring people up to date who weren't visiting maybe for our first conversation, and we want to make sure they know what's going on.
Sure thing. Packing for Mars is a film, a movie that was released about a year and a half ago, and it's which I directed and was produced with Tanya Maidenford of Screen Addiction, and we brought out a film that was exploring the sort of the modern context of a cult 1970s sci-fi novel that came out called Alternative 3.
Uh-huh.
Which was itself based on a television program,
sure.
Which was, yeah, in 1977, there was a television show aired in the UK on a show called The Science Report. And as their final show, they created the writers of the show decided to kind of make a mockumentary as a spoof that people believe everything they see on television. And
right.
They invented this story about a Mars colony that had been created by an elite think tank as a survival means for mankind, because they'd kind of assessed the situation of the Earth.
Uh-huh.
They'd looked at global warming. They'd looked at overpopulation. And they more or less decided, okay, we're doomed. We have to do something. They thought about three alternatives, and they end up with the third alternative, which for them was the most feasible because it would be most easily done out of the eye of a lot of the general population, which was to go off planet, first to the moon and then to Mars. And they would do that by essentially recruiting scientists and you know, the kind of people you would need to build the infrastructure, like engineers mm-hmm. and things like that. And then they would also bring in cultural aspects because they would need to build the colony with the help of a lot of hands, which, you know, more or less were like slaves.
Oh, it's absolutely fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. And they abducted them. I mean, in the, you know, the thousands and thousands
mm-hmm.
and would take them out. They would essentially lobotomize them or do some kind of form of modern brainwashing so that they would comply with their plans, because a lot of people would probably not willingly go to the planet Mars and work as, you know, workers with probably little pay or none. So that was, you know, kind of the gist of the story. And the way they presented it was so, you know, because it was a nonfiction science report show, usually, and people didn't read the fine print at the end of the show. Tens of thousands of people called into the station panicking and outraged that this was going on. And then they had to take a double take and step back and say, well, no, it was all fiction. We made the whole thing up.
Uh-huh.
And Leslie Watkins, the author of the book, he was actually tuned into the show. He was a Fleet Street reporter, so, you know, nonfiction. But he always felt there was a little something wrong with the space program. So he actually got approached by his publisher to take that story and make a book out of it. And that's what became the novel Alternative 3, which I think shook a lot of people around the world even more up, because
uh-huh.
it was so well researched and it was so well written by a person who writes nonfiction that, you know, people like Mae Brussel, you may have heard that name.
Sure.
She was a very sort of an iconic American researcher.
Yeah.
She was saying it was the most dangerous book on her shelf. So a lot of people refused to believe
interesting
that it
statement.
Was science fiction, right? So this was, so I decided to, and someone had put the book into my hand maybe about 25 years ago, actually, and told me the story about it being the truth hidden right out in the open. And it never kind of let me go. And then it wasn't until, of course, many years later that I was online one night and I heard an interview with a woman just talking about how she was recruited for this Mars colony. And I thought, whoa, wait a minute. And then it turns out it wasn't just any person. It was the great-granddaughter of President Dwight D. Eisenhower. So, you know, obviously someone with, I guess you could call it presidential pedigree. And I sat up and took notice and I thought, okay, is this really true? And that was for me kind of the turning point where I decided to, you know, go after the story. And that's kind of the beginning of the journey that led to my connecting then, of course, with Connie Mabey Ford. And the two of us, kind of like a modern-day Scully and Mulder, out in the reality, though, pursuing the path of these locations where these you know, because you then venture into the areas of modern secret space programs and technology that we're not really not being told about.
So this is all covered. I haven't seen
things happen.
I haven't seen the film, Frank. This is all covered in the film. How long? What's the running time? TRT on the film.
Well, it's a good. You know, it took us 5 years to make the film, so it's a good solid 2 hours of mind-blowing information. So there's a lot of stuff in the film.
Packing for Mars is now available on DVD, also limited on-demand rental at Real House, R-E-E-L, Real House. So there you go. They're still apparently you're theatrically screening it as well, right?
Yeah, we're going to be, in fact, actually going to be at MUFON even on the 22nd of July in Las Vegas. We've been invited to showcase the film there because they're having a secret space symposium, actually.
Bill Tompkins is going to be there.
Right.
That's
Tompkins.
Terrific.
And some of the people in Packing for Mars are going to be there, too. So it was a perfect match. And that's why I guess we ended up being selected to be the kind of the featured film there. So, and yeah, so whenever we can, it's a kind of film that you don't really get into the main theater outlets because A, they're totally dominated and controlled by major, studios, which block out, for their own, films, we're finding. And then, and then also a lot of theaters, they essentially want you to pay to film your screen, so screen your film. So if you want to do a film tour, you're going to have to put out, and as an independent filmmaker, we all know, making films in this genre isn't exactly a lucrative business.
No, I'd love to get a review copy if you still have any. That would be something I would definitely take a look at.
Absolutely. We'll be in touch on that. I'll just send it to you. Yeah.
Thank you. I have posted a number of YouTube videos of Curiosity and the other rover that's still working on Mars, their images that they have captured. And the surface of Mars appears to be strewn with wreckage and pieces of a once flourishing civilization that was blown all to hell somehow. There's just stuff everywhere. I've never seen so many objects. I've got one up. I'm going to be posting one. Top 100 HD images taken on Mars. And these things are inarguably created by intelligent life. There's no, you can't even get out the door to have an argument about it. It's a joke. It's real. There's stuff all over that planet. And there are so many photographs that have been released that have been smudged and changed and cleared of anything that might blow the whistle on these people. Yeah, they've been there. We've been there. We're there now, in my view. And the whole space program as we know it is essentially a canard. It's a misdirection. But this is nothing new to you. You know all this. And we've talked about it here on the program for probably 20 years.
Yes, well, I mean, the thing is, that's kind of what led us to explore some of the other areas. It wasn't just about, on the one hand, it was following the alternative three premise of a colonization for the sake of, the survival of the human genome. A lot of people, that's probably the most altruistic way of looking at it. A lot of people would be, a lot of people talk to us about that after we always put it in the most positive light, which is that if you were actually somebody who had the access to funds and the means to do something, if you knew about the impending doom of planet Earth, that you probably would just simply because you could and you felt, like you needed to do something to save the human species, but you realized that even in the case of Noah, that ancient story of the Bible, he couldn't take everybody with him on the ark either. So you can't go on to the evening news and say, okay, people, it's happening. We've got another, 5 years. So let's get ready to go to Mars. You would never be able to do it. It would never work. So these things they have to happen in secret. But the other thing is, because of what was beginning to surface, you know, during the course of making the film, we realized that the whole aspect of Mars goes much deeper than just, you know, in the modern chapter of, in context of this story. But there's actually, as you just mentioned, a lot of evidence surfacing on the planet surface that that indicates that there was more going on that planet.
Oh my!
Than meets the eye. So essentially, we went more into that. We talked to J.G. We brought J.G. Hertzog into the film.
Uh-huh.
He's kind of an astroarchaeology specialist, and we had him talking about Mars because this aspect of this ancient past was very interesting and is worth exploring because many, many people don't really know that much about Mars. You know, it's right there in our solar system, right next to our planet, but, you know, we don't really... It's funny because NASA spends so much time in the deep space probe saying, oh, yeah, there's evidence of life, like, of planets that have life-sustaining environments. There's thousands now, they're saying, you know. But it's funny, there's this thing called the Fermi Paradox, which you might be familiar with, which essentially was created by Enrico Fermi, one of the guys that was involved in developing the atomic bomb, actually.
Yeah, yeah. University of Chicago.
He was positing... Right, exactly. You know, and he was basically saying, look, there's billions of stars in the galaxy similar to the sun. You know, many of them are billions of years older than Earth. So there's a really high probability of Earth-like planets with intelligent life. He was saying that back then. Mm-hmm. And so his idea was, well, look, if there's that many, you know, if there's so many planets out there, then there must be civilizations, and those civilizations must have left a trace. So where is everybody, right? That was his thing. And that kind of became the scientific foundation behind why people don't really believe that there's, you know, the modern consensus still supported to this day is that we still have no evidence of any other life forms in the entire universe except mankind. Kind of, you know, for those of us who have delved into this topic, right? Isn't that kind of preposterous, right? So, but that's kind of where it sort of started. But the funny thing is, they spend all this time and energy and money looking way, way deep that they're actually totally ignoring what's here right in our neighborhood. And in that sense, you know, from what we found, you know, by going after this story and packing from Mars, is that the Fermi paradox is actually solved. You know, and if you look closely at what's going on, you see, like you say, those strange anomalies. There's stuff that took place also on the moon. You know, we had Jose Escamilla in the film talking about his...
Right.
He went into this topic in films he called Moon Rising.
Yeah.
And those show clearly that there has been tampering of evidence.
Oh, huge tampering.
Photographic evidence.
Huge. Colors, and everything from the colorization of it. Yeah, it just goes on and on. And these are artifacts. They're not just maybes. They're real artifacts. It's like an archaeologist's dream up there.
Well, the funny thing is, you know, if the whole rover program is run and basically and the people that analyze the data are not archaeologists, they're geologists. Yeah, so they're looking for stones. So that standard answer we always get, oh, it's just stones, it just looks like rocks, it's just rocks that look like something, right? It's because there's geologists, and the geologists are not interested in archaeological perspective. When the rovers pass along and take a picture of something which clearly looks like an artificial structure, and the geologists look at it as, well, it's some kind of rock, let's just keep moving, we can't make sense of it, you would think that, you know, they would stop the thing, turn it, go over there, and take super high definition close-up photographs
of
those
course.
Things
of
to
course.
Bring back, right?
Yeah, of course. Doesn't happen. Because we're not supposed to know. There's so many things up there. I'll be putting this up again, top 100 HD images of Mars anomalies. They're just jaw-dropping, a lot of them. Amazing.
Well, yeah, and you know, with Ken, another one that came out recently who was part of the Apollo program was Dr. Ken Johnson, who was a civilian astronaut,
mm-hmm.
who was involved in testing the entire, you know, equipment and beta testing and sorting out. He's got over 3,000 hours logged in the lunar space module. And he was at some point in his life put in charge of the photographic archive of Apollo and told to get rid of it at one point, you know, to dispose of it. And he took that as a, you know, sort of a subtle message to not destroy it, but to kind of do something with it. And if you look at the pictures in Ken Johnson's archive, what's interesting is that a lot of the pictures that were smudged out that we'd seen from Jose Escamilla and whatnot, they were actually there in the non-smudged version. And one of them in particular shows what clearly looks like a lunar city of some kind, a very straight, aligned grid work domes and lights on the dark side of the moon, which is one of the pictures that I think I sent to you. That, you know, that show, I mean, clearly that alone should be something which would make us, you know, go back, or if it was published in the public, would cause people to question, well, let's go back there. You know, why aren't we back there looking at those things? And it is funny how after the Apollo program was wound down in the 70s, it's been over 40 years, and it only really just come out of upper orbit.
Yeah, it was shut down. And the word is, what was it, Neil Armstrong said, they're here, they're parked on the other side of the crater, they're watching us.
Yes, absolutely, that's right.
So we were told to pick up our rocks and go home and stay the hell away. But we have this secondary space program going on, which would suggest that we are up there, we have a presence, we're certainly aware of what's going on up there. And probably working with at least one group of extraterrestrials. And, you know, we work with them. It's not a either-or thing. It's a combined energy, and they're doing it. And we are probably all over the solar system. I don't see any reason to restrict it to going to Mars and the moon.
It certainly seems to be what some of the whistleblowers are now talking about. They're coming out with these stories that are just so over the top,
right?
That it's very, very difficult for people to put their minds around the idea of such a secret space program. And I guess one of the first things you encounter is that people just generally say, "Well, it would be too difficult to keep this a secret. There's just no way that could be going on. Where would they get the money to
That's
do
ridiculous.
All this stuff?"
That's ridiculous. And they have so much money. Yeah. How much money do they have? As much as they want. Trillions, trillions and trillions and trillions.
It is interesting that over $10 trillion has been lost, unofficially stated to be having been disappeared from the U.S. budget.
Right, and that's what they admit
the Department of Defense
to be missing.
Yes.
What about the amount that they don't admit that's missing? Sure.
And, you know, there's this whole drug trade going on, and there's trafficking, illegal trafficking, and all sorts of commodities. It's just gruesome, actually, in a lot of ways that this stuff is happening. But there must be a reason for it, you know, aside from a certain form of addiction by a certain type of person.
Right.
There also is a lot of money to be made and to be needed for things. And, you know, when you look at the pricing of some of the parts for the Apollo program, where screws were costing $50 and things like that.
Typical ripoff. Yeah.
Right. So they were obviously siphoning some of that money off into the, you know, the Taurus program was running parallel to the Apollo program, which actually put a man on the moon before the official date. And the secret space program. But people don't really, I think where I was going earlier was just the people who don't believe that it would be possible to keep it secret often don't really know about is that whole chapter in the U.S. history starting in 1947 with the Roswell crash and the appearance of these disc-shaped objects in the sky around the planet and what ensued between 47 and 52. What a lot of people don't really go into is there really like a war between the disc people and the United States, as well as Russia. It was a global phenomenon. They were actually shooting down test rockets that the Americans were firing, the V-2 rockets. They were being veered off course. There's newspaper articles from that era that talk about this. These things were happening. There was, and the Americans, in turn, were trying to shoot down the disc-shaped craft, and then eventually they actually did to the research that we've done, actually ended up in possession of 7 of these discs. More, you know, some of them in more or less perfectly intact condition,
right,
from which they were able to reverse engineer a lot of the things that are out there now in tech, like the things like LASIK, you know, the technology to laser your eyes mm-hmm. with such precision mm-hmm. that there's no scar tissue. These are all things that are derived from that whole extraterrestrial intervention that took place starting in the late 40s and early 50s. And I think if people don't really, you know, that isn't really expressed very often, but there is, you know, now been verified with, you know, ink dating and paper dating from the memos that were exchanged at the time between Truman and Eisenhower and Alan Dulles and these people that were, you know, living at the time that it confronted this phenomenon. Of course, they were freaking out. I mean, you can imagine, Jeff, right? If, like, think of the way the world was in the late 40s. And then suddenly you're finding that there's this phenomenon of these discs that are abducting animals and humans, and obviously possess some kind of technology light years ahead of what we're dealing with.
Exactly.
And then having to confront that. These guys, of course, I believe they were totally freaked out. And I do believe their initial intention of keeping it completely secret was probably the right thing to do, because people really would have panicked in the 50s if they would have known about this. Because it's
I believe
these nice people.
Yeah, I believe that all that whole plethora of 1950s Hollywood sci-fi movies were to counter the potential of the truth getting out and people panicking. It was literally washing them in a daily routine of exposure to E.T. constantly. And that that probably stemmed from Roswell and the fact that they knew they might not be successful in keeping a lid on this thing. But they did a pretty good job of it.
That's right.
Hold on a minute. Frank and I'll be right back. Look for the second link under his name, slide material. Pull that page up. There are some knockout pictures on here of things on Mars and other things as well. So we'll jump into that right after this. Okay, and welcome back. Talking to Frank Jacob. Packing for Mars, the movie. You can download it. Look at it right now. It's quite a story. Okay, now hopefully you've been able to load up the Frank Jacob slide material, and you're on that page right now. So let's pull up the first image, and that is 3 pages from the Brookings Report, 1960. All right, tell us what's on these 3 pages, and why these 3 in particular?
Well, basically, the Brookings Report is a paper that was the result of a think tank that was commissioned by NASA in 1960 to kind of analyze and give the leaders an idea of how to deal with encountering technology or artifacts which indicate, you know, extraterrestrial life. And this paper is kind of like the foundation behind really kind of what set up the view and the stance that has survived really to this day. Because essentially, you know, it boiled down to 3 main points that were, you know, it's a long document. It's like 190 pages or something. And essentially it came down to them realizing that they're expecting to have face-to-face encounters in the next, say, 20 years, and that they would expect to encounter artifacts at some point in time on some planet that they're exploring, which would be the Moon, Mars, or Venus. And the anthropological studies that they had conducted from the past always seemed to indicate that whenever societies that were sure of their place in the universe were confronted with this information, they more or less disintegrated very quickly and essentially, you know, didn't continue on in the way that they were set up to do. And they would pay that price, you know, by losing the values and the attitudes, and it would cause general chaos. So, and the third point was that, which they said was speculated, that the groups that are the most affected would be scientists and engineers, because they'd be essentially, you know, they're the ones that are studying the mastery of nature, and that it built the textbooks and the university programs and the science and everything up around those viewpoints. They'd literally be the most devastated by getting access to this information.
Uh-huh.
So, and it would even require them to have to even maybe think in a way that isn't even possible for a brain of an Earth scientist to really understand it. So they concluded that essentially the information should not be shared if confronted. And it's interesting because this document came out in 1960, and like I was saying earlier, during the 50s, you know, when they first had these encounters, these were it obviously shows you that the pact of secrecy that Alan Dulles and Eisenhower and Truman and the NSA leaders at the time, at the founding days of these organizations, came up with, which was, they basically said, you are to swear under oath that you will never, ever disclose this information, even if you're put up on the stand in front of a court. So their protocol of absolute secrecy appears to have not bled over into even the Brookings report, because even if you read this report, there's still, you know, it's an official, publicly available report. So the acknowledgement that was made by that group of men a decade earlier is not even in there, although it seems to be the background of why that paper was commissioned, because they did confront this information and they did, you know, essentially decide never to ever reveal this information under any circumstances, because they were worried about, you know, these anthropological examples. So this paper kind of vindicated their stance. I believe it's really, from a historical perspective, it's a very fascinating document.
Yeah, well, it certainly is. All right, so that's there at the beginning. Very good. An auspicious opening. Okay, let's go on down to the next image. And all right, what do we have here?
Well, this must be the image of the Ken Johnson image of the,
it says original slide, and it's go ahead. Something
right,
on the surface,
exactly.
Of that's quite clearly of intelligent design.
Exactly. So these pictures here are kind of there to show us that this stuff was being seen, it was being photographed. And very few people have ever seen these pictures. These pictures
right.
were not made public.
Right.
The next one also, you know, the one that shows cables on the moon, this was never made public. And Ken Johnson himself, as the person in charge of this photographic archive, uh-huh. when we first encountered him, it was when we had shown the film at the International UFO Congress at the Ebbe Film Festival, where we won the People's Choice Award.
Right.
He approached us because he was there too. And, you know, I was thinking, okay, here it comes, right? An astronaut is going to, but he was totally against what I expected. He came up and he was thankful that we had created the film. And he said he'd had a lot of other images that he'd like to share with us. And some of the images in this film were, and the information we presented in the film mm-hmm. were connecting a lot of dots for him.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a very, very fascinating thing. But he told us an interesting story then about how he was, when he was in charge of this photographic archive, there was a time when he walked through a certain building in that whole conglomerate of buildings, and he found people leaning over negatives drawing.
Okay, hold on.
Them.
Which buildings are we talking about now?
During the NASA, you know, I mean, the NASA conglomerate where he was
okay,
working
the Space
in the
Center.
Apollo,
all right.
The days
yeah,
of
yeah,
the
yeah,
Apollo,
yeah.
The Space Center, exactly, uh-huh. Yeah. And he walked through a building and saw people leaned over negatives, drawing on them. And he was, you know, startled. And he asked them,
yeah, what are you doing to the negatives
here?
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And they told him, we're the professional strippers. So, you know, that was kind of his joke, about, and sort of a humorous way of saying essentially there are people whose job it is to peruse through the negatives of the photos that were taken and retouch them in a way that would eliminate things. And he had another story to tell about how he was asked to go pick up a film from mm-hmm. the archive mm-hmm. and show it to a small group of people. And it was a film shot during the Apollo 15 mission over the dark side of the moon. And he spooled it up and he showed it. And there's this scene where they're flying over the backside and they see this crater and they're coming up over this crater. And in the crater are clearly visible dome-like structures. And he was just blown away when he saw that. And he noticed all the guys in the room just looking at each other silently and nodding. And then that was it. He took the film back into the archive, but he was so blown away by it that he had to tell his brother about it and some friends, and he wanted to show them the film a week later. So he went a week later and he checked out the film again, and he spooled it up and played it in front of a room full of his friends. And guess what? Those artifacts in that crater were gone. And he was just, you know, he couldn't believe it because it was only a week earlier that he'd seen them. So something had taken place during that week to obviously erase those negatives in the film. And for him, that was kind of his wake-up call to that there's actually something going on here that isn't being disclosed to the public. And like anybody else, normally you're outraged when you encounter this because, you know, this is stuff that belongs to the human heritage. This information and these documents that they're filming up there, and if they're encountering artifacts and buildings or even another civilization, we need to know. And apparently somebody doesn't believe that we need to know. So that's what those photographs are about.
Very, very good photographs indeed. I'm glad you put this together. It's a mind stretcher.
I mean, there's a lot more, but I didn't want to put up like tons of them. These are ones that I think are very interesting because they're very
clearly
visible.
The cable is clear. It's right there.
Exactly.
And one wonders, what is this stretching from and to? And was it communications? Was it power? Who knows? Who knows? And who's cleaning the solar units on the Curiosity and the old rover on Mars? Who's polishing up those solar panels? They look like they've been Windexed at times. Oh no, it's just dust devils and some kind of strange electromagnetic activity. No, it's not. Somebody's cleaning them.
Well, has there ever been an explanation officially by NASA as to why those panels
are always
clean?
I did read once, it was a dust devil. Well, if it was a dust devil, wouldn't it be more dust?
Right. I mean, that would just drive dust into the parts.
Of course. Anyway, it's nutty. When you see a picture where it's so occluded with dust, you can hardly make out the solar aspects of the panels. And then the next picture shows the after, and it looks like it's been Windexed. Same. It's that clean. So, okay. Now, next up is a picture of one of the truly most remarkable men that I've had on the program, Klaus Dohna. He is a tremendous researcher. Tell us more about Klaus.
Well, Klaus Dohna is someone that I was put in touch with very early in the process of filming Packing for Mars. And because he lived just literally 2.5 hours from me,
uh-huh.
I drove out and got to know him, and I realized that, you know, he just had this mind-blowing information about what they call UPARTs, or out-of-place artifacts.
Yeah.
These are things that he has documented And he was a curator for the Habsburg estate. So he would do exhibitions of the royal family's treasures and photos and pictures and belongings around in different countries. So he was highly respected as somebody that was a legitimate, you know, museum curator. And as a result of that status, he was at some point in his career approached by people that had these artifacts that didn't fit into the modern context of history. And that fascinated him. And that for him began his turn in his life toward gathering more and more of these artifacts. And he ended up putting together an exhibition in 2001 at the end of the first ever of its kind, over 400 unexplainable artifacts gathered from around the world that are clearly unexplainable and clearly show that there's some other civilizations or some other technology in history there out there, which is undeniable, which has taken place. And this particular picture, there are some artifacts which, you know, when Tanya came on board, we intensified our relationship with Klaus over the years, and we've released that picture, the Klaus Donner Chronicles, is a cover of a DVD that we did with Klaus, because he actually had no books or films or anything out there officially, so we decided to help him get that going. And that picture of the Klaus Donner Chronicles is the first of we're hoping, a whole series of films that we're going to be making with Klaus, the Klaus Donner Chronicles.
Oh, wonderful. He really deserves it. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And this is up-and-coming stuff, but those pictures that on to the right of that you see are some interesting artifacts which he was given access to out of Mexico. And the reason they're there is because exploring this aspect of astroarchaeology in the film, we had the lead to go talk to Jerry Wills. And Jerry Wills is, I don't know if you know this, but he came out a few years back as essentially an extraterrestrial who'd been left here on Earth from Tau Ceti. And I thought, okay, I mean, somebody said to me, I think it was Alfred Weber, said to me, you need to have an extraterrestrial in the film. And I thought, okay, an extraterrestrial. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people make claims about being extraterrestrials, but, you know, you don't know what to think of it and what to make of it. But I decided at that point, I was curious enough, and I checked him out a little bit, and he definitely seemed a very interesting, fascinating man. So we ended up filming an interview with him that is in the film. And in that interview, Jerry is talking about, he's talking about the technology that use to traverse across great distances, which is not based on the usual linear propulsion mechanisms that, you know, were being sold in the mainstream now. It's more the quantum physics model. But one of the more interesting things that we wanted him to talk about was the ancient Mars. And he told us a story about the Mars history that dates back about 12,000 years ago. Okay. So these artifacts that we're looking at here essentially have an importance to the film because several of them were carbon dated. And the carbon dating clearly shows that these things can be anywhere between 6,000 and 12,000 years old. And literally, the few of them that we see in these pictures are only just scratching the surface. The next slide, you see the actual lab reports that came from the University of Arizona. And in Germany, there was a thermoluminescence report done. And it's obvious that there had to be some, like if Jerry's story panned out, then there would obviously have to be some kind of evidence, you know, some kind of a communication. Because he was talking about a communication, a civilization that communicated and traveled between Mars and Earth at some point in time about 12,000 years ago. And these artifacts that Klaus had been given and that were not carbon dated were, for us, kind of the clear evidence that something actually did live on planet Earth and had left a historical record in the form of these artifacts.
Right.
So, and as it turns out, there actually is a name for this civilization. It's actually called the Aztlan civilization.
Spell it.
And the Aztlan, sorry?
A-S-L-A-N?
A-Z-T-L-A-N, Aztlan.
Okay, got it.
And the center of focus for this civilization is around the Huaylas de Alisca area in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And what's fascinating is that it's not just, you know, there's not just a few of these things. Sometimes you often hear sensational reports coming out, like we've all been privy to the Jaime Maussan events and things where they found an artifact or a slide or something, right? And people flip out and go, my God, you know, we found a piece of evidence. What's amazing about these artifacts is that there's literally hundreds of these things. There's so many of them that, you know, it's actually drawn people to that area to begin try to find them. And it's even actually, unfortunately, as a result of this attention, there's been a whole kind of like a tourist industry that's popped up around it, and people even make fake versions of them as well. So there's fake versions of them out there, and then there's real versions of them. And so the people often will take the fake versions again and say, well, they're fake. You know, obviously they've been proven fake, so they throw the baby out with the bathwater. However, it's not so easy to write it off because there are real ones, and those ones are the ones that were carbon dated. Obviously, you can't carbon date a fake artifact being, you know, between 6,000 and 12,000 years old. So the next slides, you know, that are there show just a couple of these artifacts, and they're very interesting to look at because they seem to depict space travel by some group of people, and the crafts that they're showing in these pictures are the traditional, as you might say, UFO disc type craft.
Yeah,
and you also see a lot of instances of either a comet or like a planetary body that appears in these things. That seems to be, you know, I don't know. I'm not really an anthropologist here, but it just seems to me that the story Jerry Wills gave us about a calamity that took place about 12,000 years ago with the arrival of a large body that passed through our solar system and created essentially havoc and reset civilization because of the massive destruction effect that it had, that these surviving stone engravings have maybe pictures, have documented pictures of this event or of this coming event. So
I'm not sure which picture you're looking at right now. We looked at Klaus, and then we went down below that to the University of Arizona.
Yes.
Where
the
are
next
you?
Picture shows. Yeah. The next picture would be the one to look at.
Okay.
The round one.
Yeah. It looks like it's almost turned 90 degrees clockwise, but it's not. Well, it could be. If you turn it 90 degrees clockwise, you get the guy sitting down with his legs up. But that could be simply for being boosted up in the air. I don't know.
Well, it's
you got the disc above him. Yeah.
Right. And to the right of that, you see this planetary body that I was referring to with kind of a jet stream coming out of it, or it indicates could be a comet or whatever. Just it has this, and you see this a lot. I mean, I just put up a couple of these images, but there's really hundreds of them, and you see this form of a planetary body appearing in many dozens of them. So this seems to have been some kind of important thing or aspect that took place during this time that was registered.
Now, this artifact is from what period again?
This is from about 12,000 years ago.
It looks like it was a necklace at one point. There's a hole in it at the top for somebody to have worn it.
Exactly.
Pretty eclectic stuff for people to be wearing 12,000 years ago.
I would say.
Yeah. Very good. All right, that's a good one. Now, are these Klaus possessions?
These ones are from Klaus. We've got some other leads in the meantime, which are directly in the area that live on the land that have been sharing some of these with us.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to put a lot of them out there because I just want to respect the integrity of the people that have provided
good for you.
These to us.
So
I think they're worth
you know?
And
they're
there's
priceless
another one that I put up. They are. They're absolutely. And I've held some of these artifacts, and it's a very eerie feeling to know that you're holding something which is not a fake. You know, there's a lot of people, like I said, that have been making fake versions of these because they've leaked out. And the archaeological groups are not, the official archaeologists are not, they're not embracing these findings. They are ignoring them, or in some
completely
cases even harassing.
Well, they don't want
people.
Their careers to be destroyed, Frank. That's
right.
If they go against the grain, they're out of it. They're gone. That's it. Their education's gone. All that time is wasted. When we come back, we'll look at the bronzish looking object being held up by two hands, and that's a doozy. All right, hold on a minute. We'll be right back with Frank after the top of the hour break, and lots ahead.